98.7 Podcast. You're listening to Thabo Mdluli, midnight to 3 a.m.
Midnight to 3 a.m. You are on Power Zone. That's the hashtag Power Zone on Twitter. And I am Thabo Mdluli at Power FM 987. Peter Penner, good morning.
Good morning, Thabo. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well. Good to have you with us again.
Yes, it's great to be on the show again.
So, Peter, the president of Cote d'Ivoire is having a go at changing the constitution. It's been a long time coming. He promised this in 2015 during his campaign.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's been a long process for the allies of Ouattara and himself as well. The original constitution that Cote d'Ivoire has been functioning under came after the coup in 1999 and was put into effect in 2000. Mm-hmm. And that constitution was actually superseded by a power-sharing agreement that came into place to end the civil war that was taking place in Cote d'Ivoire in 2002, in 2003, in that period of time. And since then, Cote d'Ivoire has been operating under the 2000 constitution, as well as this power sharing and peace agreement that was forged in Marcosis in France. And so Ouattara was essentially trying to confirm some of the changes to the constitutions and make certain things permanent.
So what was the agreement then that was reached in Marcosis?
So the Marcosis agreement, which was brought about between then President Laurent Gbagbo of the Popular Front in Cote d'Ivoire, he was the president at the time, and a number of rebel groups that were fighting against the government, led by Soros Guillaume, as well as Ouattara was not necessarily associated directly with that, but he was allied with some of those groups. And that agreement established the criteria for running for president, because one of the major concerns in Cote d'Ivoire was in the 2000 election. Ouattara and a number of other candidates were basically ruled unable to stand for election because they didn't have both of their parents being Ivorian.
Right.
And that was in their constitution, that both parents had to be Ivorian. But a lot of people in the country, in Cote d'Ivoire, are migrants. So they have one or both parents who are born outside the country, for example, from Burkina Faso or Mali or other surrounding countries. And Ouattara has at least one parent who is from Burkina Faso. And so they were using that to exclude him from the presidency. So in in running for election. So that was a problem for the rebels and those who were his allies. So in that agreement, they allowed for him to stand for election, though the constitution still said you needed both parents to be of Ivorian birth.
Mm.
And so in the new constitution, that issue is clarified in saying that you don't need both parents being Ivorian to run for president.
So that was one thing. This temporary measure was kind of like a loophole for him that allowed him to get in even without citizenship, which was a key requirement for him to be president.
Absolutely. And it's not just about Ouattara and this issue of what they call in Cote d'Ivoire, Ivorité, or this nationality question, but it's a nationality question that is broad-based because there are a number of migrants, as I mentioned, from other countries who are attempting to get, who have lived in Cote d'Ivoire for many years and who are attempting to get citizenship rights. And so they see their sort of common struggle with the president as well, who's faced that issue in terms of his eligibility for the presidency.
So what is he seeking now? He's seeking to make this Marcosis framework permanent. That's basically what he's arguing, right?
Yes, he's trying to do that in terms of particularly on the eligibility issue of who can run for president, as I just mentioned. But there are a number of other aspects that he is changing in this process. And those are major institutional reforms. One is the creation of an upper house or a Senate. Right now in Cote d'Ivoire, they have just a lower house and then a presidency, and the lower house is the National Assembly. There's a pretty powerful president of the National Assembly in which since 2011, the last election, there are no opposition MPs. And the reason for that was after the 2010 election, the opposition of Laurent Gbagbo was, you know, forced out of power and they didn't participate in those elections. So right now, there's just that National Assembly, and it's full of allies of Ouattara, his associated parties. And so a Senate would be created under this new constitution. And one sort of concerning element of the Senate that was put forward is that one third of the Senate would be appointed by the president directly, and then two thirds would be elected from the citizens. And President Ouattara suggested that this one third that would be appointed from the by the president would lead to greater power sharing, in the sense that the president can appoint people who are underrepresented in society, minorities, or even opposition folks to that, you know, to fill that one third of the seats. But some of the concerns that I and many others have in terms of looking at Cote d'Ivoire, who have spent time in Cote d'Ivoire, analyze the situation, is that oftentimes this leads to, you know, reinforcing the power of the presidency through appointing those seats and then also dividing opposition parties. You know, if you appoint some opposition parties to those seats, most likely that could dilute the power of an actual opposition to the presidency.
In simple terms, this is a constitutional coup. I mean, in broad terms, that's what they're saying, because the president will be able to appoint a vice president, and mainly the people will be people that that are in his favor.
Absolutely. So the vice presidency seat, as you mentioned, is that other reform as well. And so that's, at least for this next foregoing process, they can appoint that VP, and that can be a very strong ally. It can signal a successor sort of program of the president, both at the, being able to change the president of the National Assembly as well as the vice presidency. So that's a fair amount of power. And I think the Senate, you know, really drives that home in the sense that you have the power to appoint those folks in what is supposed to be a representative body. And what is interesting to note in this process is the timing of the constitutional referendum. It took place on the 30th of October, which is not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. And it occurred at the time where parliamentary elections are about to take place in Cote d'Ivoire. So it took place in an environment in which the parliament was largely controlled by Ouattara, and there was little debate within parliament because opposition aren't represented. So the timing is also suspect on some of these reforms as well.
Some of the reforms as well. I mean, one of which I think we have been debating and talking about in the last couple of days, of the age of head of states in Africa being quite old, and one of these reforms suggests a change to the minimum age for presidential candidates, lowering it all the way to 35. Would you say that's a progressive move?
I think that's a progressive move. I don't know necessarily whether that's going to lead to younger candidates contesting election. I think I don't think that's going to have much of an impact. I think actually there's a more interesting thing on the upside, because Cote d'Ivoire had maximum ages for presidential candidates, and those numbers were actually raised, I believe, to 75 years old. And so they've pushed that maximum up, and they've also moved the minimum down. So the minimum age probably isn't going to have much effect, because a lot of those people who are vying for this presidential seat, you know, coming up and as well for the future presidency, are quite old within the part, and they've spent a great deal of time within Ouattara's party or the other allied parties. So you see the old guard firmly in control of these political parties. And when you visit Cote d'Ivoire and you go to the party conventions, as I have, and you notice that taking place.
Mm-hmm. Has there been broad based consultation as far as these reforms are concerned? Because I see opposition party is crying foul.
Yes, I mean, I will. So let me take you through the sort of consultative process. And you're absolutely right, Thabo. There have been a number of issues with that process. So there were a number of stakeholders that were identified by the government as being important in the constitution process. And they saw these stakeholders not as veto players or being able to exercise necessarily political power over the process, but they wanted to hear their voices. And that was a variety of different civil society organizations and a number of opposition parties, because I'd like to mention right now that Cote d'Ivoire doesn't really have a united opposition. There are a number of smaller parties that are formed because the main opposition party, or the main party that used to be in power, was really broken up after the end of the 2010 election. So there are a lot of different opposition factions out there. So they brought together this group, and throughout June and July into August, they had some meetings with this group. And then the actual draft of the Constitution was presented to Parliament formally on October 5th, which is actually just 25 days until they actually held the referendum. So the actual referendum was August 30th, as I've mentioned. And so the opposition was very concerned, one, because these consultations did not really provide them any political power over the process, just they could say what they felt. That was a concern. And they also didn't have power of Parliament. Second, it didn't involve reaching out to citizens on the local level. And citizens were eventually going to be the ones that would vote on the referendum, but they weren't included. The average citizen wasn't included at all in this process outside that group of identified organizations and stakeholders. And three, there wasn't any sort of campaign period that took place around the referendum. And this was a big concern because in many African constitutional referendums, including the one that happened in Zimbabwe back in 2000 and another one in Kenya in 2005, they've actually been a focal point where people in the opposition have actually coalesced and voted down constitutions. In both cases, Zimbabwe, Kenya, they voted down a constitution. Mm. But there was no time to organize that campaign. And that was one of the major concerns for opposition parties.
Now, what are the citizens saying about this? In terms of this reform, the political system, and how do they feel about their protection of their rights?
Well, that's a good question. So part of the Afrobarometer project, we did survey Ivorians. The data is a slightly older, but a lot of these attitudes on democracy and rule of law don't often change necessarily from survey to survey. But those results came from the end of 2014. And we found that a vast majority of Ivorians, 82%, felt that they need a range of political parties to have choices in their democracy. And 59% believe that opposition parties were silenced by the government always or often. So those are pretty high numbers that corroborate a lot of what some of the opposition parties are saying about their ability to navigate the situation. In addition, we found as part of that survey that a majority, 55%, were not satisfied with how democracy worked in the country, and 48% believed that the country was either not a democracy or a democracy with major problems. Mm. So we see a lot of citizens highly discontented with the way things work, particularly the way the opposition is dealt with in the country.
Has this resulted in major protests, maybe major demonstrations?
It did result in some protests, but one thing that your listeners have to be aware of in Cote d'Ivoire is there's a high level of sense of fear in the country that has persisted from the civil war through the post-election violence from 2010. And people are really afraid to come out into the streets because security forces are very present and very vigilant about any sort of what the government views as disruptions, and many would view as peaceful protests. And a number of peaceful protests were broken up during the constitutional referendum piece. In fact, the former president of the National Assembly of Cote d'Ivoire, a man named Mamadou Coulibaly, who was president of the National Assembly from 2000 to 2011, 2010, so a number of years, a big opposition figure, was one of those arrested during these peaceful protests. And a number of others were involved in those as well. So there were a great number of protests, but those met government resistance, and people don't feel comfortable in Cote d'Ivoire coming out. And we have a lot of evidence that there's this sense of fear that persists in society broad-based. So it's very hard to hold an open and free campaign around a referendum in such a climate.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the president is going ahead with this referendum. I mean, the legality of it, has it been challenged in the court of law?
Not to my knowledge, has it been challenged in that sense. And that partially that's because a lot of the government institutions are not seen as independent of the government itself. So that's one of the concerns. And as you mentioned, the referendum did happen on October 30th, and according to the Election Commission, 93.42%, so 93% voted for the Constitution, with only 7% voting against it, but with a turnout of only 42%.
Ooh.
All right, so if we take those numbers, we can, and the opposition basically told their supporters to boycott. So if we look at those numbers, we can say, well, referendums are supposed to be a way of gaining national consensus for the population, showing that a majority have support for a major constitutional change in the country.
Mm.
But with only 42%, even 93% of that suggests that there is this silent majority, in a sense, that is not at least actively supporting this constitution of Ouattara.
What percentage do they require to make this referendum a legitimate one? I mean, 42?
Well,
I believe about over 50 or 55 would have been okay?
Well, I think, Thabo, you bring up an excellent point, because some countries put a minimum amount of either participation or a yes vote on such referendums because they really want to show a national consensus. In the Ivorian case, in the Cote d'Ivoire case, there was no minimum amount of participation nor any max, threshold that was needed. And you can see why that was an issue, because it doesn't provide any incentive for people to, get out the vote either side or to have a very rigorous campaign, such that you have only 42% turning out in those elections. And I will mention that a number of people question those results in and of itself. Because one of the issues in Cote d'Ivoire is that the Election Commission and the leader of the Election Commission, Youssef Bakayoko, is sort of seen as an ally of Ouattara in the fact that he played a very key role in declaring the election for Ouattara back in 2010. And so they don't see him as independent. So a lot of them don't have trust that an election will be independently managed from the government itself. And it wasn't helped by the fact that he appeared at the polling station with the president on the day of the referendum. And a lot of those photos sort of circulated through, social media, suggesting that the Election Commission wasn't as independent as it was claiming in even holding this referendum.
Talk us through the two separate ballot questions instead of a single proposal.
Yeah, so my co-author did a lot of work on this as well, Abo Bala, who's actually a master's student at the main university at Abidjan. And his analysis of this in contributing to this article was that there were a number of different elements that you could strike down in the ballot proposal in different areas. And so this led to two different ways of voting for the Constitution. And this was a concern because the electoral law in his interpretation of it is that, you have to have one key proposition as opposed to different propositions on the ballot. That wasn't an issue that was really widely raised in the campaign push. It was more about the issue for the opposition was the sense of the fairness of the process and the consultation and the timing, the fact that it's happening before parliamentary elections in which maybe opposition parties can gain some seats and actually have a rigorous debate within parliament. Mm. So it was more of a minor issue that was there and it wasn't discussed widely.
Now, of course, the referendum has happened. Is there consensus as to what's going to happen now in terms of the proposed constitution?
Well, as I mentioned before, in theory it passed with that 93%, and they're moving ahead with it. So now the debate becomes, who is going to become vice president. There are a variety of different theories on that and how that relates to Ouattara essentially signaling some sort of successor and the fact that he can use that position to move certain people around, some of his allies around. It's sort of seen as a fait accompli right now and that it's set in stone and that's the direction. So there isn't any talk of any revision to it or that the process was somehow illegitimate or not widely supported. Those debates have disappeared. And that's partially because There's not real regional or international attention to the issue in Cote d'Ivoire. The referendum sort of crept up on everyone. And that's part of the timing and the strategy of those who put the referendum up, is to do it in such a way that doesn't gain a significant domestic attention and international attention in doing such a constitutional reform. Mm-hmm. Because as I mentioned, in Kenya and Zimbabwe, these constitutional referendums in both countries sparked huge opposition coalescing, working together across an opposition to defeat a principle and to put the government on its back feet. In Zimbabwe in 2000, it was really one of the coalescing moments for the MDC in the country. In Kenya, it was the coalescing moment for the Orange Democratic Movement, the main opposition party. So one of the fears of the government with this timing was that, you know, if they prolong the process, you'd allow the opposition to really coalesce, build up their protesting momentum such that they could then build that back their opposition party. So it was very quick, and now it's viewed as it's already done. You know, what's the next step? How can we implement this? And what they're talking about now is implementing the Senate, not after the next parliamentary elections, but sometime next year in dealing with the Senate configuration.
On final analysis, Peter Penner, do you think the president, Ouattara, violated the electoral code in any specific way as far as you're concerned? And what does this do for the national reconciliation effort in the country?
Well, I won't say whether he violated or did not violate the electoral code directly. But there is this sense of rule of victor goes the spoils logic of centralization of power that is very prominent if you visit Cote d'Ivoire, if you've met with a lot of these stakeholders, Mamadou Koulibaly and others who I've personally met with and interviewed for a variety of projects that I work on. You see that there is this centralization motive and tradition in Cote d'Ivoire, but it's also present in a lot of other Francophone countries that share some similar characteristics. Mm. And as you mentioned, national reconciliation was supposed to happen after the 2010 elections. And a lot of people, you know, that when you talk to those who are involved in the commission that was dealing with national reconciliation, it's resoundingly clear to almost everyone that process failed. And this constitution referendum, as it is, as it's supported by only 42% turnout is underlying it, it doesn't show that this was any effort to really bring people together to move Cote d'Ivoire forward on a different dispensation, particularly in the way that opposition parties, this was done at a time when opposition parties are not able to exercise the kind of power they would need to feel like their voice is heard to contribute to this process. And so that's very concerning for this constitution at its birth, and may open the door in the future to further revisions if others, you know, see this process as flawed and need to build, you know, rebuild that national consensus.
I think even broader for the rest of the continent, the big question of concern should be whether or not we are satisfied, whether democracy has prevailed here, and it's a major concern for most of the countries on the continent, on whether or not our democracy is thriving and progressing in the direction that it should be going.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think one of the key issues for democracy broadly, and I can speak for my own country, the U.S., which is we're heading towards election. You're now on our election day, November 8th. And one of the big issues that happens, particularly in many countries, is this issue of the power of the executive. How much do these executive have to do things? And in Cote d'Ivoire, the executive is the key focal point in the country. The National Assembly really has not so much power vis-a-vis the executive. And by diluting it further, by adding a Senate, adding all these elements, you're further diluting the power of legislature so that they become simply rubber stamps. And so that's one of the key problems that I see facing when we look outside of Cote d'Ivoire and we think generally that's there is this executive power and the delegation of ruling parties who are in parliament to an executive power. So it's not only the president grabbing power and holding on to that executive power, but it's it's their allies in those legislative bodies that are supposed to be the people's voices or the people's representatives who delegate that authority increasingly to executives. And we don't just see that in African countries where sometimes institutions are weak, but we've also seen that in my own country of the U.S., delegation more and more towards a powerful presidency.
People have been talking about that in South Africa. I mean, the president appoints that guy. The president must appoint the judiciary of inquiry. The president appoints ministers. The president. Do we give too much power to presidents in Africa in general?
I think we do. I think there is too much power in the presidency. I think South Africa has actually a very unique opportunity to deal with that issue because, in theory, the president is supposed to be, in its unique situation, is accountable to the parliament in a very unique way that, you know, for example, in the U.S. and in Cote d'Ivoire, where branches are sort of separate and equal, the president in South Africa is sort of in the legislature just a little bit more. And so there's that unique, perhaps a unique opportunity for a check on that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The president and that centralization of authority seems to persist more and more. And so when we talk about African politics more broadly, we're always talking about individuals. And why are we talking about individuals as opposed to oftentimes established political parties? And that's because personalities matter for who takes that top seat and who that top seat will distribute resources or positions or other patronage resources to. And that leads to conflict. Mm. I mean, when you have one position holding that much power, if you win, you're inside the fold, you're in the game, you're making money, yeah. The allies of the president are living. Yeah. But if you're outside, you're discontent. And that leads to long-term instability of regimes and democracy over the long term. And that's also the concerning thing of this powerful presidency.
Peter Perna, let's leave it there. Couldn't have said it better. Absolutely well articulated. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, Thabo. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Peter Perna, researcher and PhD candidate in the political department, Department of Political Science at the Michigan State University, joining us from the United States. Getting ready to vote any minute now. I tell you what, we'll wake up tomorrow. Donald Trump will be president. We will all be shocked, folks. We will absolutely be shocked. By the way, we're touching base later on with JP Klopper, CEO of Brand's Eye, looking at the U.S. elections, the social media analysis, and what has come out of there. Have they seen some major shifts in terms of sentiment on the back of all the controversies surrounding both candidates? And we know of late the whole issue of the emails has come to the fore and whether or not that has impacted Hillary's campaign. There's been lots of talk around vote rigging coming from Trump. What are people saying around that and all those conversations that are happening around those campaigns? Those are coming in just a minute. But first, though, we have a look at what's happening with the G4 faction in Zimbabwe. I mean, when you heard President Mugabe talk about Pastor Muarira, you would have thought he is not listening to what the people are saying. I mean, he literally called him a person non grata, somebody who should be stoned to death, I suppose, and kicked out of the country, saying we have no place for them. But with Pastor Muarira out of the country and people continuing to protest, largely fueled by that This Flag movement, I think it's becoming clearer and clearer to President Mugabe that people are tired of corruption, largely, are tired of corruption, and they need him to deal with this issue of corruption. Now, if you know, there's one thing that President Mugabe cares about is his grip on power, and it does seem that is threatened in this particular point, and that's why he's decisively dealing with his own minister, Minister Moyo, Jonathan Moyo, is feeling the heat there. We'll find out in a moment how much heat Jonathan Moyo is feeling. Prof. Changa Mire joining us on the line. Let's take a break. When we come back, we look at the political situation in Zimbabwe.
Power 98.7 Podcasts.